The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this October 2nd, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. Subscribe. I am your host, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. Two quick things before we begin. These days, we are inviting listeners to write in and tell us how we are doing. We love your feedback, what you want to hear more of, favorite authors, format, whatever. We're just doing a little survey to look for ways to improve. So give us a shout. You can find Barbara at penonfire@earthlink.net. You can write to her there, penonfire@earthlink.net. You can always write to me at mariestone@gmail.com. Second, Anne Patchett is joining me for the hour this morning, and I have two hardcover copies of her new book, The Dutch House. As you may know, it's KUCI's 50th anniversary, and in honor of that, for your $50 donation, we are giving away these books to the first two people who call in or who donate online and let me know. So if you are so inclined, give us a call this hour, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI, or go online at kuci.org to donate, and then you can drop me an email. Let me know that you donated, and I will send you a book, Marie Stone, two R's in Marie, M-A-R-R-I-E, Stone, @gmail.com, and I will send you a book. Onward with Anne Patchett. Anne Patchett is the author of seven previous novels, The Patron Saint of Liars, Taft, The Magician's Assistant, Bel Canto, Run, State of Wonder, and Commonwealth. She was the editor of The Best American Short Stories 2006 and has written three books of nonfiction, Truth and Beauty, What Now, and most recently, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Anne has won various prizes, including the Penn Faulkner Award and the Orange Prize for Fiction. Her work has been translated into more than 30 languages. She is the co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee, where she lives with her husband and their dog, Sparky. I understand Sparky is a pretty integral employee of Parnassus. He's featured on their website, which you should check out for all sorts of reasons. ParnassusBooks.net is where you can find out all kinds of great stuff. But it is her latest we're chatting about this morning, along with writing and craft and books in general. The Dutch House is published by HarperCollins, and you are going to love it. Anne, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. So you have said many times that sort of the connective tissue in your whole body of work, at least in your fiction, is this idea of either families being upended and tossed together in this new family unit, or strangers otherwise being thrown together in intense circumstances. And the Dutch House is certainly no exception to that. You sort of returned to familiar territory here, but as always, you took it in a whole new and unrecognizable direction from your previous novels. So I'd love for you to just sort of introduce the book, kind of what was on your mind when it was conceived, and take us into the world, and that'll sort of set the stage.
Sure. I first got the idea for this book actually when I was interviewing Zadie Smith. I own a bookstore in Nashville called Parnassus, and I interview a lot of writers when they come into town on stage. We'll do on stage conversations. And we had both just published novels that were being hailed as very autobiographical. Mine was Commonwealth, and hers was Swing Time. And I was asking her about that. And I said, you know, are you the main character? Are you the daughter in this book? The mother is like your mother, the father's like your father, this is the town you grew up in, the girl wanted to be a dancer, you wanted to be a dancer. And she said, it is a very autobiographical novel, but I am not the daughter, I am the mother. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. And she said, and I'm not that mother. She said, the mother that I wrote is the mother that I am afraid of becoming. And that's what autobiographical fiction is. It doesn't mean that it happened to you. It's that you're writing through some part of yourself that you're afraid of. And I thought, that's genius. That's the best description of autobiographical fiction I've ever heard. And I thought at that moment, what am I most afraid of? I am afraid of being a terrible stepmother. And so I write a book with a really terrible stepmother in it. And that was, that moment was the beginning of the idea. Now, it took about 700 turns and twists from there, but that's where it started.
Almost like a fairy tale, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me recently, it's very Cinderella. I said, no, it's really very Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, right, right. That's interesting. So you would say that your first draft self might not recognize the final product of what it became?
In this case, that's true, which is not the way it ever goes for me. But I wrote a first draft of this novel that I threw out and started over again. The way I usually work is that I write and revise and write and revise as I go along. And so when I get to the end of the book is really very close to being finished. Whereas I did that with this book. I got to the end, I read it, I just hated it, and I threw it away. And I wound up going back and taking the basic threads and writing a new book.
Mm.
It was a learning curve. It was actually kind of amazing to think, oh, you know, here I am in my middle 50s, and I have a pretty sizable career. I didn't know I was capable of writing so badly. But lo and behold, I still am. just like when I was young.
That's so funny. So was it a structural fail? Was it a character fail? Or it was just the story didn't hold together? Plot, okay.
It was a plot fail.
Okay.
The book went left when it should have gone right.
Gotcha. And do you unwind it from the beginning at that point, or do you just figure out where in the strand you went off the rails and start from there?
No, I really threw the whole thing out and then tried many times to pick it up in different ways from different places. Didn't work. And then a friend of mine months later said, go back and look at the beginning again. No one read the book that I threw away.
Okay.
And she said, see if maybe you can go back to it. And it turns out that I did wind up using the beginning that I had written, but everything went in the opposite direction this time.
Very interesting. Going back to this notion of sort of the collective theme that kind of runs through all of your work, I was also wondering if your areas of concern as, you know, as either writer or as woman, human being, have changed over time as you keep writing, that there's that one enduring theme of families that necessarily didn't start out together being kind of tossed together and forced to live like that.
And you know, oddly, this book is a lot less like that than my other books. This really is about the primacy of family of origin in a way.
Yeah.
My hope was that when I wrote Commonwealth, I was getting it out of my system once and for all. But certainly traces remain, which is not a bad thing. I think most of fiction is really about family to some degree or another anyway. There are issues of wealth and poverty come up through all of my books, issues of class. I write a lot about race, which didn't figure into this book at all. But those are the things that definitely come back, and I could try my best not to write those things, and they would still be there because that's who I am.
Sure, right. So you've said the thing that you struggle with in your last book tends to lead to the next book, you know, that something didn't get resolved. And I was wondering if that was true here, if there was something that you had wanted to accomplish in Commonwealth or that was difficult or you struggled with that you set out to accomplish in this one.
You know, that's not exactly right. It's more that I do something in a book that I really like that is sort of not the main thing in the book. For example, when I wrote Run, there was a character in the book who was an ichthyologist who studied fish. And I really, really enjoyed writing about science.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I wrote State of Wonder, I thought, I really want to write a book that is about science. So it's more like that. Something that was small in one book becomes big in the next book. And with this, I really enjoyed the brother-sister relationship in Commonwealth, which was a relationship between a stepbrother and a stepsister. But I found that tenderness and that conversation to be so interesting. And I thought, oh, in my next book, I really want to write a book that is entirely about a brother and a sister.
I love that. I love that. And I love the choice of the point of view character is the little boy. It's first person. Well, I mean, through much of the novel, he's a man, but
yeah.
He starts out a little boy.
He got past the point where he was a little boy.
By page 25, he wasn't a little boy anymore. But,
right. But if you bailed out on page 24, yeah. He was always a little boy.
But the nice thing about that is that you chose a character who didn't have as much access to all of the family history and the family. He just wasn't there for the time that the family was really kind of falling apart. And so alongside the reader, we got to learn with him kind of, you know, backstory and relationships and all of that. And I thought that was a really neat way to, you know, he if you looked at it, he might not, to me, be the most obvious point of view character. And it was just wonderful that he was, because he wasn't an unreliable narrator, but he was a lesser informed narrator who we got to learn along with. And I was wondering if he always was your choice for who to tell the story through.
Yes. And this kind of goes back to the last question, too, because when I was writing Commonwealth, which was a very autobiographical novel, I had always said I would never write an autobiographical novel. I just wasn't interested in that. And then I did, and I really enjoyed it. And so I thought, okay, what is the other thing that I've always said that I would never do, maybe I should do now, and it's write a book in first person. My first two novels were in first person, and I struggled so hard to learn how to write a really good third-person narrative, an omniscient narrative, that I felt like I had outgrown first person. So I thought, well, it would be really interesting to go back and write a book from a first-person point of view. And I always knew that it was going to be Danny. I didn't look around at the other characters at all. That's kind of how I got there. And really, when I threw the book away, I thought a big part of the problem was I had found writing in first person so hard. And so when I started it over again 17 or 18 times, I was then writing it in first person, and it didn't work at all. And then I went back to the first person and to Danny's voice, and it did work the second time.
To that point about how many times you had to go back and do this, was there ever a time that you were like, this just novel wasn't meant to be? Like, when do you decide that you're truly going to abandon something versus, okay, there's something to be salvaged here? I mean, are there novels in the drawer that you're just like, that was never going to work?
No. I do so much thinking through of my books before I write them that I don't make a lot of mistakes for the most part.
Yeah.
I make the mistakes way up front, way, way up front before I write them. But once I really get going on something, I'm usually fine. This is a book that is in three sections. And the first section was great. I mean, I had it. The second section, the first time I went through, was mixed. It was falling apart. And the third section completely went off the rails. So when I went back, it was the beginning ultimately turned out to be okay. And then I just sort of reconfigured it all from there. But I never thought that I wasn't going to write this book. I remember so well the day I was reading the whole thing through. I had finished it. I was reading it. A friend of mine was here working on his novel. And I kept going downstairs and saying, I've just got to get to the end, and then I'll figure it out. And I finally got to the end, and I said, yeah, I figured it out. I have to throw this away. It's terrible. Mm. But I remember what it felt like was, it was like I had burnt a cake. I had made a cake, and I burnt it. What are you going to do? You know, you just have to throw it out and start over again.
Right.
You might be able to eat out a little bit of the inside part with your fingers as you're throwing it away. But, you know, at some point you just look at it, and it was so funny to me. People would say the most incredible things, like, this must be like the loss of a child. Oof. And I said, oh, my God, no, it's like burning a cake. You know, right. I screwed up. Right. I've still got all the ingredients. It's a little disheartening. It's going to take some time, but so what? I burnt the cake. It doesn't mean I can't cook.
Right, right.
That's sort of what it was like.
Well, and that's a nice thing. And that probably comes with, you know, having 13 books out or whatever, 10
yeah,
books.
Yeah.
But for a writer to trust themselves and not be filled with, you know, I think shame is such a big theme amongst maybe every writer, but certainly early writers, where, you know, you hear a lot of writers say, I don't have the time to write. And I don't think it's that they don't have the time to write. Everybody has the time. I think it's that you put something down on the page and you feel shame and you see how bad it is and you are sort of mortified by yourself. And that's just a natural part of the process. But I think early on, you know, you can discourage yourself very easily. And if you know, to have the perspective to say, hey, it failed. I burned the cake. I have to start over. No big, you know, not no big deal, but, you know, yeah. That happens.
It's a moderate deal.
It's a bit, yeah. It's kind of
things.
It's kind of a big deal, but
no big deal.
Right. But to be able to get over that hurdle of shame, I think, is important for writers.
You know, that's so interesting that you say that. I don't use the word shame. That's really not how I feel. For me, it's a more like sadness or a disappointment that I always feel and that I think everybody who writes feels, because the thing that's in your head is always so much more beautiful than the thing that you put down on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, I'm not ashamed of that, but I always wish I was smarter. I always wish I was more talented. That is part of it. And I have often said that my genius is an ability to forgive myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that I can say I am doing my best work. And that's really, really important. I mean, when I was young and I was writing short stories, and I would always think, well, this isn't as good as I want it to be, but it's because my boyfriend broke up with me, or it's because I had this other paper due, or it's because I'm so broke and I have to have a second job and I don't really have time. You know, there was an excuse.
Right.
And at some point, I realized that what the excuse does is it means I'll never have to figure out how good I am, ergo I will never have to figure out how bad I am.
Right.
So at some point, I thought, okay, I'm going to write without excuse. I'm going to do my very, very best work. And if it's not good enough, I will still know that is as much as I was capable of.
Yes, right.
And removing that little boundary that says, oh, well, it might have been 2% better, or it might have been 98% better. It's like, no, this book that I wrote that you read, I can't do any better than that. That's my best work.
Right.
If it's not all it can be, or, you know, somebody else could have done a better job, that's fine. But it is the best I can do.
Yeah, I always think this notion of, you know, writers always want to know, do I have it or do I not? Or is it a matter of talent or is it a matter of time? And, you know, for you who was published in the Paris Review at 20, maybe it's a matter of talent. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a matter of putting your nose to the grindstone, and anybody can get better. But can you get good enough, I guess, is the question that a lot of writers have. And, you know, I guess it's the eternal question that you can't quite answer. But,
well, you know, I think that talent and imagination and creativity and inspiration, it's like having a match. That's wonderful. It's important. You have to have a match. But again, I'm 55. I've been doing this since I was a kid, really and truly since I was a kid. And if you're going to have a career and make a living, and this is my job, it's really not about imagination or talent or creativity. It's about splitting wood. You know, if you're going to spend your life living in a warm house, the match at some point, yes, that started it. Thank you. Thank you, match. But either you're going to get out and split wood every day, or, you know, you're going to be cold.
Right. Right. So I have to go back and talk about my favorite character in this novel, which is the house itself, which is, you know, I just thought the house is both perfect character and perfect symbol and so alive and so, yeah, I mean, you know, you could just see it and feel it and feel like you were inside of it. And so the first question, I guess, is that how it felt to you? Did you kind of have a model of this? Do you have drawings of it around your office? Did you live in it too?
No, it's just, you know, I can't really see the house.
Really?
It's more God is in the details, you know, just by really focusing in on certain characteristics and describing those characteristics, then I could give the feeling of the house. But I really didn't know if the house was Downton Abbey or just a really, really nice house.
It's Downton Abbey.
I never really got the scale of it all. And I think that that's important, you know, to say, I'm going to talk a lot about the dining room ceiling. I'm going to talk a lot about the little tiny dysfunctional kitchen and the carved mantles and, you know, those kinds of things, the window seat. But I'm not really giving a picture of the whole house because everybody has their dream house. Mm-hmm. Everybody has the most beautiful house in their mind. And I really wanted to bring the reader in and use the reader's imagination in that way and let it be the fabulous place that you see. And it's why the most important thing to me about putting this book out is there not be any architectural detail on the book. That there could not be a cover with a house on it. Or even a window or a door or anything, because I want it to be the reader sees that for herself.
Right. I thought it was the perfect character and the perfect symbol. I mean, I just saw it as sort of the American dream and what the American dream means to different people and who has access to it and who is denied it.
Yeah.
And almost America itself, which came home in a detail at the very end of the novel that I won't give away, but it was, there's a detail about the house that sort of made nod to it, you know, to almost being a symbol of the country itself and what we are going through, what we have gone through. And
that also was very much an inspiration for the book. Mm. When I was thinking about wealth and poverty and this American idea that everybody wants to be wealthy. And the wealthier you are, the more successful you are, and the better your life is going to be. And that is not the case in this book. And I think that is not the case in life. But that a character actually looks away from the house and says, this is not what I want. I am embarrassed. I am ashamed to be in this huge, gorgeous house. A couple of years before my husband and I got married, and we dated for a really long time. We dated for 11 years before we got married. And I had been nominated for a big international literary award, which I did not win. And my then boyfriend, now husband, was convinced that I was going to win. And he thought, I mean, this is like so hard for me to even say. He bought me a Mercedes convertible, like an old one from the 70s, a really pristine, it had been in a garage forever, it had 1,000 miles on it, it was this two-seater, and he brought it to my house, we didn't live together, with a bow on it, and it was, that moment also really informed this book 20 plus years later, because I knew that it was love, but I wouldn't be caught dead in that car. I mean, I had an old Honda. There's no way in the world I would drive around in some snazzy two-seater convertible.
So I have to understand, he bought it for you in anticipation of you winning, or he bought it for you in a consolation that you did not
win? No, in anticipation. Like the card came an hour before the prize was announced.
So it's already imbued with the prize.
Which was fine. I never thought I was going to win this prize. It was the Dublin Impact. I mean, it's like the last prize anybody thinks they're going to win. It's like saying, oh, I really had my heart set on getting the Nobel that year. You know, it wasn't going to happen. But that if the way this worked, he bought it from a Mercedes dealership. I had 24 hours to give it back.
Oh.
It was a nightmare. It was absolutely a nightmare. But yeah, not everybody wants.
Right. Not everybody wants the same thing. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And not everybody wants to be rich. And I do think, in this day and age, we are so far away from remembering that.
Well, and in the book and in your marriage case, the same principle holds, which is that we give the gift that we would love to receive. We imagine, you know, the thing we want the most in the world that represents the pinnacle of success, we would give to someone out of love. And it's just tragedy all the way down there. So
right, which is why I would have given my husband a puppy in this
circumstance. We're going to talk about that puppy. I introduced that puppy and you missed it, but we're going to talk about that puppy. But the other one thing that I wanted to bring up about the book and about other things that I think had been on your mind. I heard you give a talk a couple of years ago about fashion had been on your mind and things that come into fashion and fall out of fashion. And I think actually the word was used in the book to describe there's a ballroom on the third floor of this building that was fashionable at the time. And
can I tell you about that ballroom?
Please.
So yeah, this is a three-story house with a ballroom on the top floor. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. There are lots, I mean, I won't say lots, but there are some big old antebellum homes around here that have ballrooms on the third floor. And a very, very close friend of mine from college who lived in Elkins Park, who grew up in this town outside of Philadelphia where the book is set, was one of the very first people who read the manuscript when I had finished it the second time. And she said, there is no such thing as a ballroom on the third floor.
Oh, true.
She became so insanely fixated on this that she was sending me emails every day saying, I'm telling you, you're going to make a fool out of yourself. There is no such thing as a ballroom on the third floor. The ballroom is on the first floor. And we went around and around and around about it for like a month. It was crazy. And finally, you know, I talked to architects. I was like, yes, there are ballrooms on the third floor. And then there were not. And
oh, no.
So I put that sentence in to satisfy Erica Schultz that, you know, yes, it was a fashion, and then ballrooms were no longer on the third floor.
That's wonderful. That is wonderful. But it is interesting of what is in fashion and what is not in fashion in the book. Yeah. I mean, as we talk about poverty, you know, who has access to dream, you know, as our country is shifting beneath our feet as we're sitting here, what is fashionable and what is, you know, what is important to look at. And I love all these books coming out, speaking of fashion in literature, of the swarm of books of, you know, people of color that are coming out and these discussions of race and who has had access to the canon and, you know, who has not. And, you know, all of these things are very relevant. But I felt like that must have been on your mind while you were this discussion of fashionable and whatnot as you were writing this.
Yeah, well, the whole thing of fashion really comes from owning a bookstore, and that I used to read, I think, the way most people read, which is just all, I shouldn't say most people, I have no idea how most people read, the way I always read, which was all over the place. I would read a Henry James novel, I would read a Toni Morrison novel, I would read Emily St. John Mandel, I would read a Dickens, I would, you know, I just went all over the place, all over the world, all over time. Now, everything I read is a galley. Everything I read is 4 to 6 months away from being published. When I'm unbelievably excited about a book, I can't talk about it because it doesn't exist yet. But because I read so currently now, I really do feel like I read fiction and nonfiction the way other people read the newspaper. And I do see how we are as a society reflected back through fiction, which, you know, again, if you read broadly over time, you don't get that picture. And that has been a real revelation to me, that there really is fashion. And I go back and I read the writers who I grew up on and I loved, the writers my parents read, Updike, Roth, and Bellow. Those were the three writers that I read through high school and college and graduate school and loved and still love. But a few years back, I went back and reread the Rabbit Angstrom novels, which were so important to me, and I think they're so brilliant. But I also feel like I'm not sure those books could even be published now. They would be so incredibly out of fashion. And I love them, and I'm thrilled that they exist because they're a time capsule of America.
Right.
But, man, they wouldn't make the cut now.
Right, right.
Bellow, I don't think anything Bellow ever wrote could be published. Roth is different. I think Roth is different.
That also brings up that whole interesting question about whether you can separate, not with those gentlemen, but whether you can separate the artist from the art. And, you know, if you don't have high regard for the artist, if they've fallen out of favor for whatever, you know, sexual indiscretions or racist comments or whatever, if you still value the art they produced separate from who they are. And,
yeah, I can answer that.
Yeah, please do.
I'm good at this one.
Okay, good.
It's easy if they're dead. You know, Picasso put his cigarettes out on his girlfriends. Mm-hmm. And that does not mean that I don't go in and look at the Picassos when I'm in a museum, and that I don't appreciate them and learn from them and sometimes love them. I do not, for me, I really can look at the art outside of the person. If the person is still alive, then I think it's a little trickier, and there are people that I wouldn't necessarily want to have dinner with, but it... I'm very hesitant to expunge anyone from history, especially in art, especially for making the mistakes artists made. I mean, my God, if we listen to Wagner, we can do anything.
Right, right. Good point. I guess the that's a totally separate question, but also one that intrigues me, is in the world we live in right now, there's a big discussion about cultural appropriation in literature and who has the authority to write what. And both as writer and bookseller, I'm curious about your point of view on that, because it feels like there's a great raging debate in the literary community about who can write what story.
You know, basically anybody can write any story. Anybody can write anything they want. There is no thought police. There's no editor in the room. The question is whether or not you do a good job. Mm-hmm. And if you do a bad job, chances are you'll never publish it. No one will ever see it. If you do a bad job, an offensive job, and it does get published, then you're going to have to take your hits. But no one can tell me that I am not allowed to write something. Mm-hmm. People can tell me that they hate it, that they will not read it, that they vilify it. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
I mean, Imagination can go anywhere. And I also believe that in many cases it is essential to imagine another life, a life that is different from your own. It's what we need to do, is imagine other people's lives. But it's interesting. I picked up a book, I can't even remember if this book has been published yet, and I don't think it has been. But it was a famous author, and it was a book about women in Cambodia. It was a man who was a Caucasian American writing a book, a sweeping family, multi-generational saga about women in Cambodia. And I started to read the book, and I thought, wow, you know, I just am so much happier reading Bin Jin Lee writing Pachinko. You know, if I'm going to read this, I would rather read men doing it in Japan about Koreans.
Right.
Yes, I would.
Yeah.
So I put that galley down, and that is my right, and it surely is his right to have given it a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the question is a different one from what you have the authority to write versus what a publisher is going to take, right? So you can you can write whatever you want, and they can choose
write
to take
whatever you want.
Yeah.
And the fact is, if you do an amazing job, it will rise up.
Yes.
And how do you want to draw the lines? Like, am I not allowed to write a book with a first-person male narrator?
Well, that's the question, is if you go down this path, everybody would just be writing memoir and autobiography, and who wants that?
So, you know, that's really a nightmare.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, you know, if you, your characters have so much compassion, obviously all of these characters aren't you, and yet there's some bad people in here, and yet you feel you see their point of view, you see how they see the world, and maybe what made them the way they are, or they have some, you know, illness or something that makes them more compassionate or something. You know, I mean, there's always something that you can attach yourself to characters and feel, you know, sympathy, empathy, whatever the word is,
right,
compassion for them. But has being a bookseller changed at all your writing? Because I always, you had said, I'm always writing a book that I don't see on the shelves, which I feel like is kind of a different question than I want to write the book that I'd like to read. Because
yeah,
you're looking at these people every day who walk in and put books up,
yeah,
and pick them down. And, you know, I was just wondering if that changes the way you approach your own work.
It does change my original answer, which was I write the book that I want to read, to I write the book I want to sell. And this is a crazy thing to say, but I really had no idea before I had a bookstore how many bad books there were. And there are some books that are so good, you just can't even believe it. But it's a real buckshot approach. And again, if you read throughout time, you can always find something magnificent. If you read the books that are coming out in January, you might not find anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a surprise to me. So part of it is I do have a greater sense of just, oh, man, I just want to write something really good.
Yes.
As simple as that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Are there books we should be keeping our eye out for now that you've pre-read all the galleys for us?
There is a book that's coming out in February. If, you know, if everybody has a little post-it note they can write it down on.
Yes.
And it's called The Resistors, and it's by Gish Jen. Uh-huh. And I think if ever there was a book that might save us, that really might save the world, that might save this country, it's The Resistors. I am so excited about this book. That said, there's a book coming out in November by Kevin Wilson called Nothing to See Here, that I love, and I love Kevin Wilson.
Mm.
And there's a book, two books out right now in July that I love. One of them is Margaret Rankle's Late Migrations, which is just such a gorgeous piece of nonfiction, and it's by Milkweed Press. Mm-hmm. And I want to just go out into the street and scream in the top of my lungs, you have to go buy this book because it's Milkweed. It's just this beautiful, beautiful, quiet book about nature and family. Margaret writes the op-eds in the New York Times on Mondays. And Colson Whitehead's Nickel Boys, which is a book that I've read all of Colson's books, and I'm such a devoted fan. And I, you know, I read Underground Railroad. I read Underground Railroad and Galleys really early on, and that was certainly a very tough book. And but you know, I read it. I just sat down and read it straight through. The Nickel Boys. Have you read it?
I have not. I heard him on Fresh Air, and the review of it, but I have not. I have not read it yet. But it just looks fantastic.
It's a little tiny book. It's like 200 pages.
Okay.
And it took me 3 tries.
Wow.
I kept getting to page 30, and I just it was so painful.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's so worth it. And so amazing to think, I read Underground Railroad, and I didn't flinch.
Oof.
And I, right? Okay, I'm tough. This book brought me to my knees.
Oof.
And it is genius.
Yeah,
it's such a tough sell because people will come into the store and they're like, I'm not sure I can do it. I'm like, you can.
Right.
It's really hard, but you can do it and you'll be a better person for it.
Right. Yeah, you need to do it. Those are the books we need to be reading. And this idea of reading really across time and across genre. And I sat down yesterday and tried to read Clockwork Orange again. It was just hard.
Ow.
And I was like, it's just hard.
Ow.
Mm. Right. I mean, you just have to make yourself do that. I mean, that's probably better than getting an MFA is just making yourself read. And
It's true. And again, going back to reading outside your comfort zone, reading those 4 Rabbit Angstrom novels to me is like getting an MFA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just anything you need to know about writing fiction in there.
Yes, right. We'll go off and do that. I want to be respectful of your time, but is there, I'm sure there's lots we didn't talk about. Are there things that you would...
We didn't talk about Sparky.
Oh, I know. Well, I introduced Sparky. You missed that because I dropped your call. I introduced Sparky, and I told everybody to go on the website, which is ParnassusBooks.net. And there are wonderful. First of all, there's a great piece on there with Diane Stahl. Is that who did it? The Today Show did it with just talking about the importance of independent bookstores and supporting independent bookstores. And God forbid you go on Amazon unless you have to, but don't. And they're great pictures of all the dogs, Sparky.
Yeah.
And he works hard at the store. I love that.
It's true. He works much, much harder than I do. Okay, I'm going to tell you 2 other really interesting things about the book.
Good. Okay, good.
In fact, if you would like me to just tell you these 2 things, and you want to put them as questions?
Okay. Just tell them. No.
Okay, so the cover is one of the most amazing things about this book. I am so excited about the cover of this book because a friend of mine did it.
So
the painting on the cover is the painting of Maeve, the main character, and the painting is in the novel.
Yeah.
And I really wanted that to be the cover of the novel. And I told the publisher, and my editor said, yes, we think that's a really good idea. I said, I have a friend who I think might be able to do it. And my editor said, well, okay, that's good, but we're going to interview some painters in New York and talk to some different people. And I got off the phone and I thought,
no.
That's not a good idea. And so I called Noah Soderstrom and I said, can you do this? You know, it would be a painting of a 10-year-old girl in the 1950s, but it should be painted in the style of the 1920s, and the painter was from Scotland. And here are the two paragraphs in the book in which the painting is mentioned. And he said, oh, yeah, I can do that. And 4 days later, he painted that.
Wow.
And
wow.
So before HarperCollins had the chance to put together a list of painters, I came back with that painting, and I bought it. They said, oh, we'll buy it. I said, no.
No, right.
And actually, for the first time, I have said that all international editions have to use this painting. I don't care how they use it. I don't care if they just use her left eye. But it has to be that painting.
I love it.
And the other thing is,
I'm going to say, I'm so glad that you said that, because I tend not to bring up covers on galleys because I don't know if that's the final cover, so I never mention them. But that it is unbelievable. And you so rarely get an image of a character. And so I was like, hey, I actually know what she looks like. I thought her hair was weirder based on the descriptions, but her hair looks lovely.
And that also, it feels so much like a collaboration because at some point you realize, oh, my God, that is the painting of her.
Yeah.
And people will say to me, where did you find that painting?
Yes.
And I'm like, no, that's actually a painting of Maeve.
So great.
And the other thing that is amazing about this book is that Tom Hanks did the audio.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Mr. Rogers. He's now playing Mr. Rogers. That's wonderful.
That's so exciting.
That really is. Wow.
But those are the two things that I always really want to shine always. This is like, the third interview I've done for this book. The fourth one will be in about 10 minutes.
Yikes.
But I love shining light on those two facts because it's you don't get to collaborate on things
as a
novelist.
Right.
So I love this.
That is wonderful. That's wonderful. Any last minute words of advice that sustains writers that they ask you and they've thanked you for giving it to them?
I was just taking care of my neighbor's dog, and he sent me an email about an hour ago saying, thank you for taking care of the dog. I really want to write a novel. Do you have any advice?
Oh, geez.
And I said, yes, I do. So I wrote a book of essays called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. And in that book, which is a book about commitment to all sorts of different things, including dogs.
Yeah.
But there is a very long essay, about 50 pages, called The Getaway Car, which is every single piece of writing advice I have. It answers every single question anyone has ever asked me about writing, publishing, discipline, work, school, reading, all of it. And whenever anyone asks my advice on something, I always say, if you read this essay and you still have a question, come back and I will answer it. And no one has ever come back. Maybe that's because they're bored to death, but I really think I covered it all. So, The Getaway Car is everything I've got.
I'm so glad you said that because our interview today is 45 minutes and I was going to stretch it to an hour for the show. And that was going to be my little lecture was from the other 15 minutes I was going to spend, talking about The Getaway Car. So perfect. You introduced it so well. That's perfect.
I can talk to you for another 7 minutes if there's anything else you want to talk about.
No, this has just been wonderful. I could go on forever. I guess the other question about bookstores, book selling, and I would just love for you to give me some comfort about the future of books, if you can. We were in such a lull for a while, and it seems like independent bookstores are making a nice comeback, and they've become
a
great place for communities to gather and whatnot. Do you see what do you see the future of being here?
It is really, really the case, and I know that in terms of working with the American Booksellers Association. I mean, this isn't just some feeling. The numbers are on the rise. There are more independent bookstores opening. They are doing better. And I do think you don't miss the water till the well runs dry. And we watched our independent bookstores close, and then they started coming back. And I think that people really woke up and said, if you want an independent bookstore, you have to support it. It is so simple. Money drives the car. So if that's what matters, and you've got a little independent in your community, then it is incumbent upon you to go and support it. And, you know, not just show up for the author events and then go home and order the book on Amazon. And certainly in Nashville, we've been incredibly lucky, and I love it. People come up to me in the grocery store and say, oh, kids, this is the lady who owns Parnassus. And it's like they're meeting Santa Claus. So I definitely see a trend towards people valuing books and bookstores and that place in the community more and more. I think that the difficulty in so many cities is rent.
Yeah.
And when people say to me, you know, what are you doing now that's so great that other bookstores weren't doing in the past, and so they closed? And I was like, no.
Yeah.
They were doing it great. They were working hard and doing a great job. I've never known a bookstore that just really wasn't getting on the stick and doing a great job. It's just that sometimes the rent goes up in such a way that your profit isn't enough, you know, that you can keep it going.
Right.
Even if you're selling a ton of books. And certainly, you know, in big cities, we see that more and more. The fact that we have such a great relationship with our landlord is, to me, the third partner in this whole process.
So, yes.
Yeah, I mean, love your local independent bookstore, but frankly, your local independent everything, you know, the gardening shop and the hardware store and the liquor store and the grocery store and the fabric store, and, you know, whatever it is, stop and think, I could save 20 cents on those cotton balls, but I am supporting my neighbor, I'm supporting my local economy, and that's what drives all of this. And I really didn't understand that until I became a small business owner.
Right. And it's another excuse to get off your screen from ordering, get off your screen in general. I know I admire that so much about you, that no screens and no social media and no texting, all of that, I think, is the death for writers, or, you know, the death for all of us, really. Let's be frank.
Yeah, I do feel like I live in a zombie movie in which everybody's walking around looking at the palm of their hand.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's not like I did it and I stopped. I never did it. And I don't understand what could be happening to people's brains.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Hey, that's a whole other show.
That's a whole other show. That's exactly right. Well, Ann Patchett, thank you so much. This was just wonderful.
Thank you. I had such a good time talking to you. And, you know, I used to teach at UC Irvine.
Did you really? Oh, my gosh.
Right. For one semester in the MFA program when Jeffrey Wolf ran it.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'll send them your regards over here.
Please do.
That's wonderful.
All right. Take care.
Thank you so much. You too. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.